brought a few books here with me because I want to talk about a subject that is very much on the minds of a lot of people today because of what is going on in the Middle East. I think everyone is keenly aware of that, and if you're like me, you follow it carefully day by day. Have to get up in the morning first thing and find out what has happened, what's the latest. But it is something that's on all our minds, and certainly it's something also that's on the minds of many people who sell books like this one, Late Great Planet Earth. This was first printed back in 1970, and this is the, this is the 12th printing of July 1971. So I received this book by way of, it was a birthday present that a cousin of mine gave it to me because he knew I was interested in such things. So I got it back then. I think it was 1971 when I got this book, and saw some things in it right away that some things seemed to be pretty good, biblical. Other things seemed to be very much unbiblical, like his doctrine of the secret rapture and so on. In any case, the prophecy writers, such as Mr. Hal Lindsey here and Grant Jeffrey and some of the others, some of the books I have here, are at it again, you might say. Every time something happens, for example, back in the days of the Gulf War, during the administration of the first President Bush, some books began to appear then. For example, this one, entitled Armageddon, Oil, and the Middle East Crisis, came out right at the outset of the Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein moved into Kuwait, and when soldiers and armaments and so on began to gather in the desert out there, then this book came out. I don't know if it's true or not, but I was told at the time by someone that the Bush White House ordered copies of this book, I suppose so they could find out possibly what may happen in the near future. In any case, this was written by a popular prophecy writer, John F. Walvoord, and you see here on the cover is a picture of one of those fighter jets, a scene that we saw many times on our television screens during the Gulf War in those days. The problem with that is, one of the things that comes to mind, though, is when you look at the copyright, the original copyright is 1974. You might say, wow, this guy's really on the ball. Here you have him, the preface, this information about the Palestinian problem, about the problems in the Middle East concerning Israel and Palestinians. And then it mentions in August 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded and seized Kuwait and so on. Talks about the oil problem there, the idea that had something to do with the oil in Saudi Arabia and so on. And, of course, the idea also was that Saddam Hussein intended eventually to expand his forces and to invade and destroy Israel, which is probably part of the campaign that he intended to carry out eventually, as is not an unknown desire and wish on the part of many of the peoples in that part of the world. In any case, this was first published in 1974, and in those days, the introduction began with these words. It says, each day's headlines raise new questions concerning what the future holds. It's well known that Mr. Walvoord saw the events of the early 70s, and he wrote this book in response to them, believing that what he was seeing was the fulfillment, or at least preparations for the fulfillment, of biblical prophecy. And it sold, of course, like hotcakes. Then it was reprinted in 1976. And by that time, the interest had waned because, I suppose, in those years, by that time, the scenario had changed somewhat. I don't recall now off the top of my head exactly what was going on in the world. But I understand the book didn't sell very well in its second edition. And, in fact, that you could buy them by the case for about 25 cents each. So you should have waited till 1976 to get these. You can get them a lot cheaper. But this is the 1990 edition. And I don't know if there was an edition after this one, but it continues to have revisions and updates throughout. And it's interesting because it is necessary to revise from time to time. Now, as you read these books, you get the impression that the end of the age, the rapture, that's what all of these particular books are looking for, is the rapture is almost upon us. That the second coming of Christ, of course, his first secret coming, as they would have you believe, is almost upon us. It's about to occur. It will occur soon. Now, there was a lot of energy was devoted to, a lot of enthusiasm began to build up build up as we approach the year 1988. Why? Why do you suppose? What about 1988? What was so special about that year? Well, here in this book by Hal Lindsey, The Late Great Planet Earth, he's the one that more or less set off a great deal of interest and enthusiasm in the subject. I'd like to read a little bit of this. He says on page 53, I can get my glasses on here with one hand, says, when the signs just given, and he talks about things in Matthew 24, when the signs just given begin to multiply and increase in scope, it's similar to the certainty of leaves coming on the fig tree. But the most important sign in Matthew has to be the restoration of the Jews to the land and the rebirth of Israel. Now, I ask the question, where do you find that in Matthew? He assumes that the parable of the fig tree is really a parable about the restoration of Israel. If you read the text carefully, though, you must realize that that's something he's reading into the text. It says, even the figure of speech, fig tree, has been a historic symbol of national Israel. When the Jewish people, after nearly 2,000 years of exile, under relentless persecution, became a nation again on May 14, 1948, the fig tree put forth its first leaves. Keep the date in mind. 1948. That's when Israel became a nation again. Now, later on he goes on to say, he quotes Jesus as saying, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass till all these things take place. And he says, what generation? Obviously, in context, the generation that would see the signs, chief among them, the rebirth of Israel. And then notice this, a generation in the Bible is something like 40 years. If this is a correct deduction, then within 40 years or so of 1948, all these things could take place. Many scholars who have studied Bible prophecy all their lives believe that this is so. 1948, count 40 years forward, the end of the generation, 1988. So that is why the year 1988 came to be so prominent, such a date associated with enthusiasm concerning the events described in Bible prophecy. Now, in 1998, a gentleman by the name of Edgar Wissenant wrote and distributed two books. One was entitled 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Could Be in 1988. The second one was entitled On Borrowed Time. Now, Wissenant put together a number of prophecies and historical information, and he weaved it together in such a way, and of course including the 1948 date of the rebirth of Israel, concluded that Christ would come for his faithful servants on Rosh Hashanah, that's the Feast of Trumpets, in 1988. On page 93 of the book entitled End Times Visions, author Richard Abanis says this about Wissenant. He said, Wissenant had no doubts about this date, stating, quote, only if the Bible is in error am I wrong. And I say that to every preacher in town, unquote. And he goes on, during one interview, he made a declaration that dramatically demonstrated his level of confidence. Quote, if there were a king in this country and I could gamble with my life, I would stake my life on Rosh Hashanah 88. And again, this is in End Times Visions from Richard Abanis. Now, you may say, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see how dumb such statements are. Well, I've got some news for you. Mr. Wissenant was, in fact, a former employee of NASA. He was a rocket scientist. Until he became a prophecy teacher. But he was a rocket scientist, literally. I wonder if he's the one who designed those insulation plates, those tiles. In any case, if his engineering is anything like his prophecy understanding, then better watch out. Now, the book goes on to say, this is the book by Richard Abanis, goes on to say, well, actually, he talks about how Paul and Jan Crouch, you know who they are, of TBN, Trinity Broadcasting Network. You know, that's the tall, skinny guy and his wife, the one with the lavender hair and all of that. How that they evidently bought into Wissenant's predictions. And this is what he says about them. It says, they went so far as to alter regular programming on September 11 through 13, because that would take in the Rosh Hashanah date, you know, from the Jewish perspective, observing 2 days just to make sure you get the right one in there someplace. It would start on at sundown on September 11th and then conclude on sundown at September 13th. So he gave that date just to make sure that it fell within the Rosh Hashanah reckoning. He says regular program, they went so far as to alter regular programming on September 11 through 13. Instead of airing their nightly Praise the Lord television talk show, they ran videotapes of pre-recorded shows dealing with the rapture. For non-Christians who might be watching, the revised programming included specific instructions on what to do in case Christian family members or friends disappeared and the world was thrust into the tribulation. That's on page 93 of End Times Visions. Now, some 300,000 copies of Edgar Wissenant's book were sent free of charge to pastors and ministers, elders, and so on around the country. And then in addition to that, some 4.5 million were sold in bookstores. So there was a whole wad of money that came in off of that book. Now, you can't sell it today, to be sure, but it sold like hotcakes back then. Now, when nothing happened on Rosh Hashanah, Wissenant found his slight miscalculation, and he revised the date, realizing, uh-oh, a little error here, something I left out. So he realized at that point that Christ would come for the faithful at 10:55 a.m. He found some way of finding that from the Bible, on September 15th, just a couple of days later. Well, when that date failed, when Christ didn't show up, nobody disappeared, it was October 3rd. He found another little miscalculation there. And then this book, End Times Visions by Richard Avanis, goes on to say, even when that date passed, that's the October 3rd date, even when that date passed, Wissenant remained undaunted. The evidence is all over, quoting him, that the evidence is all over the place that it's going to be in a few weeks anyway, he told Christianity Today. After his few weeks had transpired, Wissenant finally saw his error. He claimed that he had made a slight miscalculation of 1 year because of a fluke in the Gregorian calendar. Jesus was actually going to return during Rosh Hashanah of 1989, which means a new book. Wissenant published his discovery in The Final Shout, Rapture Report, 1989. The time is short, he said. Everything points to it. This publication was subsequently retitled The Final Shout, Rapture Report, 1990, and has since been retitled yearly as The Final Shout, Rapture Report, 1991, 1992, 1993, 1994, and so on. I think he went all the way out to 1997 before he finally gave it up and realized that he didn't know for sure when Christ was coming for his faithful and when they would be raptured. But in the original work, Wissenant put a date not only on the rapture, the secret coming of Christ for his church, but also other events described in prophecy. For example, of course, as I said, September 12th, or in the general vicinity there, 12 or 13, 1988 was the rapture. September 26, 1988, the 144,000 were to be sealed. On June 19th, 1989, these are specific dates, World War III between Russia and the United States would end. March 9th, 1992, the two witnesses would be killed at sunrise. April 19th, 1992, the Antichrist would die and go to hell. October 4th, 1995, Armageddon would conclude. And then the following Wednesday, Satan would be chained. And then on Tuesday, January the 1st, 3000, eternity begins. The millennium is over. The white throne judgment is over. Eternity begins. So he had all these dates. This is a rocket scientist, keep in mind. And as it turns out, he was wrong on every one of them. And he was wrong on all of his revisions. Now, Edgar Wissenant was not the first to put dates to prophesied events. In 1843, a Baptist preacher named William Miller did the same thing. And of course, it resulted in what is known as the Great Disappointment, because Christ didn't show up. Even after revisions, He still didn't show up. He didn't come for the faithful. And since then, others, of course, have attempted to set dates on the coming of Christ. Has even been attempted in certain parts of the Church of God movement from time to time, both date setting and, I will call it, near date setting. You'll notice that Hal Lindsey wasn't dogmatic. He just says it's probable, it's possible, it's a very likely date for the rapture of the church. Now, others are less precise, but their approach to prophecy is nevertheless somewhat questionable and leads to the conclusion, or at least they leave the impression that they're saying that the time is short for certain and that Christ will be coming for his church soon. I have some other books here. I won't take the time to go into them, but you find some of the same things. For example, the coming Russian invasion of Israel. Notice it says updated. Actually, it has to be updated because the original talks about the old Soviet Union. This updated version, 1987, still presents Russia as the great superpower, as if it were still the Soviet Union, having the same influence in the world, the same strength that it had in those days. So obviously these things have to be revised from time to time. Also, you have to question some of the interpretations as you move along through these books. Let me read just a portion of it here. It says, in the introduction, it says, "This book has been exceedingly difficult to write because the events the authors intended to predict, quote unquote, kept virtually coming to pass during the writing." And I'm wondering which writing is he talking about, is 1974 writing or the revised version in 1987? In any case, you see the problem there with some of these things. Now, here's one in particular I thought was interesting. And this particular author, I've seen him before on television. You may have seen him back in the year 1999 as we approached the year 2000. And I was watching television one evening and saw a prophecy conference being aired. And there was Zola Levitt and there was Dave Hunt, which I thought was the voice of reason in the whole bunch, because he was saying, "Listen, folks, this Y2K bug thing, it's not going to be a big deal. It's really not." He said, I've done the research. I've talked to computer experts, and they say that even if those computers don't roll over like they're supposed, like we hope that they will, it's not going to do anything. It's not going to make this vast difference in the world. But I remember Grant Jeffrey was in that conference, and he was absolutely adamant. And he gave the government a thrashing for not warning the people about this massive destruction of our society that was coming as a result of Y2K. Of course, you still see him on television. You still see his books coming out on a regular basis explaining prophecy. And he's one of these fellows who buy into the Bible code business, thinking that that there are prophetic codes hidden in the text of Scripture. It's just a matter of unlocking the code. Anyway, I'd like to read a little section here from this book, what he says concerning the coming of Christ and the time when the kingdoms of this world will become the kingdom of God. He's talking here in this section on the prophetic cycles, the cycles you find, time cycles you find in the Bible. He even has chapters on the annual holy days, on the temple, on the priesthood, on all these various things. He brings it all together, and he brings it down to the ministry of Jesus. And you recall in the Bible where Jesus went into the synagogue, and he read a scripture, and he said, "This prophecy, this is fulfilled in right now." He's saying that in your ears. So he says, he, meaning Jesus, began his public ministry in the autumn of A.D. 28. So it is no accident that he began by reading from the prophecy of Isaiah 61:1. And here's what it says. "When he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, 'The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and the recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord.'" That's the phrase he focuses on here. He has it in italics. "And he closed the book and gave it again to the minister and sat down. The eyes of all them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him, and he began to say unto them, 'This day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears.'" Luke chapter 4, verses 18 through 21. And then Jeffrey goes on to say, "The year when this occurred, the fall of A.D. 28, was in fact not only a Jubilee year, but was also the 30th year Israel crossed the Jordan River, the 30th Jubilee since the sabbatical Jubilee system of years began when Israel crossed the Jordan River in 1451 B.C. Thus, Jesus Christ precisely fulfilled the acceptable year of the Lord on the exact year of Jubilee, the year of liberty and release. Now, guess when the 70th year of Jubilee is? He goes on to explain how prophetically significant this year, the 70th year, is. And he, of course, it comes out to the year 2000. And he says, in my research into biblical prophecies, I have discovered several other indications which suggest that the year AD 2000 is a probable termination point for the last days. So, of course, this had to be revised. No question about it. So a lot of revision goes on in the prophecy books. And I can't help but wonder when I see events like the ones we see, like what we see going on in the Middle East right now, and you see all these books appearing. There are many others. You go to the prophecy section of a Christian bookstore, you get online, go to Amazon.com and start doing your research, and you'll find books about the Iranian crisis and attempts by authors to link that with specific Bible prophecies about what's happened in Iraq. All kinds of other things in the world. Every time something happens, see, people have even found 9/11, the event of 9/11, in Bible prophecy, they think. And all of these things you see written about, and I can't help but wonder if someone doesn't have in mind making, because, you know, we know that the Left Behind series, Tim LaHaye's series, the Left Behind series, it sold millions. Hal Lindsey's books have sold millions, multiple millions. I think that book there was a bestseller for many years. It wasn't a bestseller at one time, but I think it's exceeded all other books for quite a long time. In any case, you find that these types of books do sell very well. And so I wonder about the motive sometimes of some of the writers of these particular books. But I'm not the judge. I'm not the final judge on that. It's just something I wonder about from time to time. Now, let's look at one of the scriptures that's often cited by date setters and near date setters. I'd like to go to Matthew chapter 24 and begin reading in verse 32. This is the passage that Hal Lindsey referred to. He believes that the fig tree analogy here refers to the restoration of Israel. He believes it was fulfilled in 1948. It says in verse 32, Matthew 24, "Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near." Some translations say he is near. It doesn't matter whether it's it or he, because it's referring to the parousia, or the coming of Christ. So it is near, at the doors. "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all of these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." Now, as we've mentioned many times in the past, in context, the question was, what will be the sign? Or the first question is, when will all these things be? When will these things be? What things? Read Matthew 23. He's talking about the fall of Jerusalem. He's talking about the destruction of the Jerusalem temple, the end of the system of worship for the people living in the land, the descendants of Jacob living in the land. So that's something that they had in mind. When will these things be? And the second is, what will be the sign of your coming, the parousia, and of the end of the age? So Christ addresses these two things. And we know these two things are separated by quite a long period of time. Of course, that period, that long separation period, would not have been readily recognized, would not have been known by the disciples. So he talks about both events in this one chapter here. But then he goes on to talk about, in all this, he says, he talks about false Christs and false prophets. He talks about wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines and pestilences and all of these happy things, all these things that he says are part of the, par for the course. And then he talks about tribulation, talks about persecution, He talks about, and he goes on to describe the destruction of Jerusalem, which is what the original question was about. And then he says, down in verse 23, he says, "Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There,' do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders, so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect." And so then he goes on, leading from there, he says that the coming of the Son of Man is not going to be in some quiet corner someplace. It's going to be very, very visible, just like the lightning flash, or just like the light shining from the east to the west. Whether he's talking about a lightning flash or the sun, it doesn't matter. The point is, it's visible to everyone. And then he describes the second coming in verse 30. So I take it to mean here, says when he says, when you see all these things, he's referring to the things described from verses 4 through 28. He's not talking about verses 29 and 30, because what sense would it make? You know, does it make any sense to say, "Now, when you see me walking through the door, you'll know that my entrance is near"? That would make no sense at all, would it? So when he says, "When you see all these things, you will know that the parousia, my coming, is near." So he must be referring to the things previous to verse 29, from verse 4 through verse 28. And again, those things include false prophets and false Christs and wars and rumors of wars, pestilences, famines, etc., etc., etc. Also, the fall of Jerusalem is described in there. More false prophets coming on the scene, persecutions, and so on. Now, the problem with this is, and then the next verse, it says, "Assuredly I say to you," this is verse 34, "assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." You know, when you look at it linguistically, all of the explanations, like which generation, well, the generation when all these things take place, that's very questionable. It's not a natural way of speaking. Others say, well, this generation means this. They tie the word, translated generation, into the word meaning this kind of people, meaning the Jewish people. The Jewish people will not have passed away. Others believe that. The Jews will still be in existence, in other words. That's just not the normal usage here. So it's very difficult to make it this mean anything other than the generation that was standing right there, that existed right then and there at that time. He says, "Truly I say to you, this generation," right now. And then if you go back to Matthew chapter 23, when he describes the destruction of the temple, he says the same thing. All these things will come upon this generation. So we must take it to mean the generation then existing. Now, how in the world do we square that with the prophecy? The prophecy here, we know that all these things don't pertain exclusively to that generation. Well, the answer, I believe, is simple. And it is that that generation did see all of those things. They saw false prophets. The apostles had to deal with a lot of them. False Christs, the apostles, the writers of the New Testament, dealt with a lot of those. They saw wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes and pestilences. They lived to see, this generation lived to see the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Jerusalem temple. So that generation did see all of those things. Now, does the text anywhere here say that those things were restricted to that generation? And the answer is no. No, it does not. It does not. He does not mean that once these things happen in this generation, then the second coming will take place. No, he just says, you, this generation, will see all these things. But he does not date the second coming by those things. He just simply is saying, these are things that have to happen before I return. But just because all those things were seen in the first century does not mean that they've exhausted, they're now not to be seen again, or that they apply to no other time. That's not true at all. And there are other texts, of course, we won't take the time to go through them all, that show that there's a tension between the imminence of Christ coming and some distance between the time of the apostles and the second coming. In fact, we will look at a couple of parables that will imply just that. But in any case, all these things did happen, but those things are still happening, and those things will happen before the second coming. So it could be understood in that way. Now, continuing on, in verses 36 through the end of the chapter, leads me to the conclusion that that's the only way I can understand verses 32 through 35. It says, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For in the days of Noah, or the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark." Some prophecy expounders believe that this is talking about the tremendous amount of gluttony we see in the world today. Eating and drinking excessively. Also marrying and giving in marriage. Wrong marriages, like the current debate in the world or in this country that we see over whether or not marriage is between one man and one woman. So many think that that's what he's talking about. But if you look at the context, that's not what he has in mind at all. It's not what it's about. He is saying that life will be going on as usual, even in times of turmoil, even in times of tribulation. And you know, when we look around the world today, we see a whole lot of tribulation, don't we? I see massive tribulation in this world today. I see the threat, the very real threat of terrorism. I see global jihad underway. It's something that we know that in time, we know that there's going to be another event in this country, most likely, paralleling that will parallel the one we saw in 9/11/01, if not worse. And we know we're living in perilous times, and yet life goes on, doesn't it? There's eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, and so on. And that's what he's talking about here. And then he goes on to say, "For in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man." In other words, people are not going to know it. There's not going to be anything to precede the coming of the Son of Man that will cause people to be ready for it, people in general. And he's talking to his disciples. He says, "You don't know the day and the hour." He's not saying that there are not things that will go on in the end time to give you some general perception. But what he is saying is you can't pinpoint the time. You can't do what some of these books attempt to do. Not possible. He says, "Only his Father in heaven knows the day and the hour." He says in verse 40, "Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left." Whether this is talking about one taken in captivity or one taken in when Christ comes for his saints and is gathered, you know, when the trumpet sound occurs and the saints rise to meet Christ, whichever it may, it doesn't really matter. The point is that they're going to be going about their daily business, and one will be taken and the other left. Now, it goes on to say in verse 42, "Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming." He's not saying you need to be watching so you can figure out when he's coming. What he's saying is, the word watch here is translated vigilant in other texts. For example, we're told to be vigilant because the devil is a roaring lion. Is seeking whom he can devour. And it's the same word. So what he's saying is here, be vigilant, therefore. In other words, be always prepared. Be in a state of preparedness. Why? At all times. Even when times are good. Even when you don't see anything in the world. Let me put it this way. Even if those people over there in the Middle East settled their problems and all became best friends. I don't think that's going to happen, but assuming they did, the Palestinians and the Israelis lived together in harmony. And let's suppose that we live to see the end of radical Islam. I don't think that's going to happen, but let's suppose we did. Should we then relax and say, well, you know, the coming of Christ can't be for a long time? No. What he's saying here is, regardless what you see going on around you, you be in a continuous state of preparedness. That's what it means to watch. That's what the term in the Greek means. It means be vigilant, be awake, be aware. Verse 43, but know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready. That's the key. You be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect. So you just be ready anyway. Even if it looks like he's not going to be coming in the near future, you be ready anyway. And then he gives a couple of parables here to illustrate his point. And I don't think there's anything that he could have used here to illustrate the point in a more profound way. The first parable is the parable of the faithful servant and the evil servant. He says, who then is a faithful servant? This is verse 45. And wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season. Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him and in an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him with his portion with the hypocrites. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So here the point is that this guy does not anticipate the soon coming of Christ. He thinks, well, he's delayed his coming. It's going to be a while. It's going to be quite a while. So he falls back into his old ways. Next thing you know, he's mistreating the servants in his charge. And then all of a sudden, unexpectedly, the master comes back and he deals with that unfaithful servant. And the point here is that Christ may come much sooner than you think. Much sooner. But then he balances this with a second parable, a very important one. It's in chapter 25. And it expresses something different. It says, then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Understand that these 10 virgins, some people get the wrong impression here. They think that they were all going out to marry the bridegroom. That's not what's going on here. These were something like what we would call bridesmaids. They were participants in the wedding. The one man, the one woman were getting married. So don't any of you guys use this. Don't think you can use this to justify polygamy. Forget it. Actually, I say that because I know people who have used this as an attempt to justify polygamy. It says, now five of them were wise and five were foolish. Verse 3, those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in the vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight, all of them, not just the foolish, but the wise as well, everybody did. And at midnight, the cry was heard, behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out to meet him. Now this slumbering and sleeping here, I do not believe is a description of a future Laodicean church. Nor do I believe it is a description of spiritual slumber. It's just simply a parable. There's no particular meaning given to this other than the fact that the bridegroom delayed his coming. They anticipated that he would come much sooner. So he didn't. So what do you do? Well, you slumber, you sleep. But something else was going on here. It says, then all those, verse 7, then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, no, lest there should be not enough for us and you, but go rather to those who sell and buy for yourself. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready, that's the key, those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. In other words, there's a certain time, you know, the bridegroom is going to lead this procession. Evidently, that's how it was done. And those who are in the wedding procession, the wedding party, go with him. And then when the door is shut, you know, you better be in there, or you're not going to be a part of the party, as it were. So this is what's going on. And while these are gone, the foolish virgins are gone, this takes place. And it says, verse 11, afterward the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, assuredly I say to you, I don't know you. It says, and then here's the point. Watch, therefore, be vigilant, be ever prepared, For you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. Now, what's the deal here? These people anticipated the imminent coming of the bridegroom. They thought he would be right out. He'd come right along. They were ready for him. And then they didn't. Some of them did not anticipate. Actually, all of them didn't. They did not anticipate a delay in his coming. So here you have two parables back to back. In one, the servant did not realize that the master was going to come back so quickly. In the other, five of the virgins here did not anticipate that it was going to take such a long time. And his point is that regardless of what you see going on around you, regardless of what the conditions may appear to be, you simply don't know. Therefore, you be ready at all times. Now, the present situation in the Middle East provides yet another opportunity, as I said earlier, yet another opportunity for somebody to make a lot of money selling prophecy books. Or should I say, false prophecy books. When I look at the sorry condition of this world, when I look at the serious threat of Islamofascism, when I look at anti-American and anti-Israeli sentiments throughout Europe, where secularism reigns supreme, where Christianity in any form is basically dead, and where the only form of religion, fundamentalist type religion, is found in the Islamic communities there, and I find that I no longer view these things through the prism of Bible prophecy. I'm not trying any longer, as I did years ago. I do not any longer try to figure out precisely where we are in the prophetic timetable. I don't do that. What I am doing more and more, and have found in recent years that I tend to do, and that is that I become concerned as to regarding what is happening, and I have hopes for how things will turn out. I don't sit back as perhaps I once did and say, well, you know, the whole world's going to heck in a handbasket anyway, so there's nothing we can do about it. Just watch these things fall, you know, watch the world fall all around us. I don't do that so much anymore. Rather, I've become at least emotionally involved, and I have, for example, hopes for the outcome of this present war between Israel and Hezbollah, however you pronounce it. You hear it pronounced about a half a dozen different ways, Hezbollah and Israel, in any case. I have hopes for the outcome of that, but I don't attach that to a particular set of prophecies, because I don't know. It may be that this thing will be resolved in ways that I can't foresee, and that many years will go on. On the other hand, it may quickly result in things happening in such a way that the only deliverance that any of us would have is Christ comes quickly. We don't know, do we? What we do know is that we need to be prepared. And, you know, rather than sit back, as perhaps I once did, and not get in any way involved, only sit back and watch things happen and assume that, well, you know, it's prophesied, it's going to happen anyway, nothing we can do about it. Rather than take that attitude, especially in things such as the social issues of the time, such as abortion and such as redefining the idea of redefining marriage. Well, you know, there are things that I can do. I can write letters. I can participate in programs designed to keep some of those things in place. For example, traditional marriage and fight abortion. There's nothing wrong with getting out there in a peaceful demonstration and participate in an anti-abortion rally. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with writing to your representatives and tell them what you think. Nothing wrong to, for example, writing to an embassy when you know that, you remember the guy in, where was it? You remember the guy who converted from Islam to Christianity in Afghanistan? That's where it was. And he was facing a death sentence. Well, a lot of people wrote to the embassy, and there might have been a response. The people got involved. There's nothing wrong with doing those things. So rather than sitting back and just watching things happen and assuming that it's all, you know, almost like it's predestined, and instead of just assuming that the world's coming apart anyway and nothing you can do about it, why not get involved. You know, Christ gave a parable about the Good Samaritan. And he talked about a Samaritan who helped someone who was injured, where these other people, the religious types, passed him up, left him laying there. We know that that pertains to, it applies to individual situations. But does it not apply to a much broader situation, a community, a nation? Anything wrong with getting involved so that you can help to make things better in the here and now, rather than trying to plug everything that you see going on into a prophetic timetable? I think that's the way to go. Bible prophecy, after all, is not merely a timetable of predictions for the future. It is a call to action.